This episode is sponsored by Universal Pictures 1917 from Academy Award-winning director Sam Mendes, winner of 2 Golden Globe Awards, including Best Motion Picture Drama, nominated for Directors Guild, Producers Guild, and Writers Guild Awards, as well as 9 BAFTA Film Awards, including Best Film of the Year. For your awards consideration in all categories, see 1917 on the big screen, now playing at theaters nationwide.
Hello, and welcome to The Real, the podcast where culture and entertainment meet. I'm your host, Mark Olson. On today's episode, Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, screenwriters of Dolomite Is My Name.
If you look at our body of work, we kind of like telling the same story over and over. We like telling stories of completely passionate people with what's kind of a bad idea, but they really believe in their idea and it's important to them and they want to express themselves. And so they're pushing a very big rock up a very steep hill and everyone in society is saying, just stop it. Just give up. Just turn around and go the direction the rest of us are going. But our person says, no, no, no. This is just something that's important to me. And I'm going to keep pushing this rock. And we like telling that story.
That's coming up. But first, we've got to talk about the Golden Globes. The awards show happened on Sunday, January 5th, and here to discuss all this with me is entertainment columnist Glenn Whipp and TV critic Lorraine Ali. Thank you both for being here. Lorraine, I'm going to start by asking you to talk a little bit about not so much the awards in specific, but more the show. You reviewed the show for the paper, the host, Ricky Gervais. There was some level of buildup to his performance, and then there's been a lot of talk about it afterwards. What did you make of this particular iteration of the Golden Globes?
It was an interesting one. You know, initially it seemed like it might be kind of flat. It might be kind of like a somber event just because of here we are in the new year and world events have been a little difficult. And it felt strange to have this, you know, celebratory award show dropped in the middle of it. But then you figured, you know, Gervais was going to do something to rile that up. When it got in there, I thought it was really interesting to watch him do his shtick with the audience, which is making fun of Hollywood. But then Hollywood kind of like was not in the mood for it this time. And it was this really interesting juxtaposition to watch those two things happening because he was not getting a rise from the crowd like he did usually. And it felt like it was almost like Hollywood won over him. You know, that was one of the bigger awards of the night. You know, they triumphed over his kind of flat hosting. You know, in the beginning of the telecast, Gervais had come out and said, don't make your speeches. Don't come up here and talk about, you know, just thank your God and get off the stage. No political speeches. So, of course, what does everybody do? The first award goes to, you know, Rami Youssef from the Hulu series Rami. And he goes, I'd like to thank my God, Allah Akbar. You know, he goes off and I thought, okay, this is great. And then it just rolled from there. You know, Russell Crowe about the Australian wildfires, Joaquin Phoenix, you know, everybody had gotten up and pretty much said, and of course, Patricia Arquette. So it was kind of just Hollywood taking back the show in a way. It was a response. I felt like it was a response. And maybe they didn't plan to get up there and say anything. But then once he came out and said that, it was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to get up there and say my piece about, you know, XYZ climate change.
Glenn, looking at the Film Awards specifically, people always talk about, do the Globes matter? Do they, like, impact the Oscar race in any specific way? And especially given the shape of the calendar this year, does that mean anything more or less for the Globes impacting the race?
I mean, if you're listening to Ricky Gervais, they don't matter. I think he mentioned that about, what, 12, 30 times during
25.
The show? But this year, awards calendar constricted. Very tight. Oscars 2 weeks earlier. So ballots were out. I think a lot of people are voting later this year because Tuesday was the deadline. Christmas break, holiday break. People were busy watching movies. It's the same thing every year. You never watch everything you want to watch. They're saying, I got to get to these movies. And you get to a lot of them. The night before you vote, I'm watching 2 movies, maybe 3. And then you vote. It's the same with the Oscars. Cab members are telling me, I don't have time to watch all these movies, but they're making an effort. But I think the effort this year is going to be a lot of late voting, a lot of people casting their votes after the Golden Globes. So did they tune in and watch some lovely speeches? I mean, all those people who won Globes were going to get nominated for the Oscars anyway. I mean, what they're doing is making their case for maybe why they should win the Oscars. And personally, I would like to see Joaquin Phoenix finish his speech that he's got played off of the Golden Globes, because, I mean, who knows where that was going?
Well, I have to say, I actually really enjoyed Joaquin Phoenix's speech. I thought that it was, frankly, more together than you might have expected for him, for his, even the extent to which it was a little bit shambling, and that he said some very emotional things. He said some sort of self-reflective things. And yes, they began to play him off when he said, maybe we shouldn't be taking private jets to film festivals in Palm Springs. Actually, I think he said award show. The idea that, like, he kind of even went a little too far, and that's when they played him off, I really enjoyed, like, hey, leave us our private jets. I think specifically some of those winners, Joaquin Phoenix, Renee Zellweger, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino, were pretty expected. I felt like the wins for 1917 in particular, for Sam Mendes and director, and then also as best drama, felt like they had a little bit of a jolt of surprise to them. Is that a movie that maybe, since it's still coming out, maybe the conversation for it is still evolving? Is that a movie you think that the Oscar world has been sort of overlooking up till now?
It started screening Thanksgiving weekend. They've been screening the hell out of it since then. It was a late arriving film, but it picked up Producers Guild Award nomination, Best Picture. It picked up Best Director for Sam Mendes. So it's being seen. Still, its victory was a surprise because The Irishman kind of came in Best Drama Picture as the favorite. It won nothing. You know, they kept flashing to that table. Anyway, Irishman, no awards. And 1917, two major awards. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, three major awards. And then, yeah, Mendes winning for director. Whew, did not expect that. I mean, I think there was a very loud utterance of profanity in the newsroom that night that may have come from the office I was working in, because I couldn't believe that Bong Joon-ho, Martin Scorsese, Quentin Tarantino, and you're going to take Mendes, who is fine, but, you know, no.
Lorraine, so The Irishman, which Glenn brought up, being released by Netflix. Netflix came into the evening with more than 30 nominations, walked away with only two awards, two acting prizes, one for TV, one for film. What do you make of that?
Netflix is still looked at as television. I think that's part of the issue at the Golden Globes, right? And we were discussing this, that film is really king at the Golden Globes, right? TV is still kind of the redheaded stepchild. And even though in the real world, outside those doors, television matters a lot more than it did, and creatively, it's, I feel, leaps and bounds beyond film right now, I don't think that factors into how it's treated inside of the Globes and by the voting body. And my assumption would be, okay, well, it's a Netflix production. It's not really cinema. It's not really film. It's not like the kind of film that we give awards to. So, you know, it's okay when the television shows win for it, but that would be my suspicion of why Netflix didn't do as well as people thought it may have.
The TV shows that did win the big prizes, Succession and Fleabag, how do you sort of read those in relation to, say, how those shows have done at the Emmys?
Felt like Succession and Fleabag as winners, it was almost predictable, and not in a negative way. I'm not a fan of Succession, but I understand why people like it. It wasn't a super safe choice, but it was one that people thought, okay, like, it's going to do well. Fleabag the same. There weren't a whole lot of surprises. I mean, Rami Yusuf winning in the comedy actor category was probably the biggest television surprise of the night. You also had Chernobyl winning, which people thought it would. So, you know, I feel like the TV choices, they're probably reflective of what's going to happen moving forward and what happened at the Emmys before. I mean, they're kind of stuck in between the two Emmys.
Now, Glenn, one moment that I'm assuming you're going to be happy about was the foreign language category. Bong Joon-ho and Parasite were the winner there. I mean, Bong gave kind of one of the best speeches of the night. What did you make of that moment? Was that something that was exciting for you to see?
I love that moment. Yes, you are correct. But it was early in the show, and it was before the director prize had been given. So I was hoping, you know, it's the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Would it kill them to honor a movie you know, made from someplace other than the United States or England. They have such a sad track record when it comes to honoring international films. And I thought, this was the year that's just like obvious. How are you not giving the director prize to Bong Joon-ho for a movie that I don't hear a bad word about it. I don't hear anyone leaving Parasite saying anything, but it's just, wow, what a movie. So I was excited for the foreign language win. But then it was just like, oh, he didn't win director. And then I started getting depressed. I need to dial it back a little bit because this is how it's going to be at the Oscars. This is, it's going to win foreign language film, which is now international film. And then that's probably it.
So with that, we will sort of turn the page on the Golden Globes for this year. We got the Oscar nominations right around the corner, which will sort of give new energy to a lot of these conversations. So Lorraine, Glenn, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mark.
And now, it's time for Glenn Whip's Awards Minute.
When Sam Mendes' movie 1917 won the Golden Globe for Best Drama Picture Sunday night, Mendes came on the stage and he offered his thanks, and he implored people to go see the movie on the big screen for which it was intended. Those are his words. And you can't think, but maybe, just maybe, maybe subliminally, maybe consciously, he was throwing a little shade at Netflix because, of course, you can't really go see a Netflix movie on the big screen, can you? It's not made for the big screen, even though if you work hard, you can probably find The Irishman still playing in a theater somewhere. But right now, you can go see 1917. It's a movie about a couple of British soldiers going on a mission, trying to avert disaster by delivering this important message behind enemy lines. It's a movie that's constructed like it takes place in one single unbroken take, and you're moving through trenches, you're dodging artillery fire. It's a great big screen movie. Now a late-breaking Oscar Best Picture frontrunner. A frontrunner. I'm not saying it's the frontrunner. Don't get carried away. But Best Picture Drama at the Golden Globes was nominated by the Producers Guild for Best Picture. Sam Mendes nominated for Best Director from the Directors Guild. A lot of things moving in favor of this movie, 1917. A lot of momentum on its side as Oscar nominations are coming on Monday morning. The key thing, look and see if it's nominated for screenplay. If it gets a screenplay nomination, you can take it seriously as a Best Picture frontrunner. And go see 1917 on the big screen, as Sam Mendes says, for which it was intended.
Thank you, Glenn. And we're going to take a quick break.
This episode is sponsored by Universal Pictures 1917 from Academy Award-winning director Sam Mendes, winner of 2 Golden Globe Awards, including Best Motion Picture Drama, nominated for Directors Guild, Producers Guild, and Writers Guild Awards, as well as 9 BAFTA Film Awards, including Best Film of the Year. For your awards consideration in all categories, see 1917 on the big screen, now playing at theaters nationwide.
And now we're back. And I'm here today with Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, screenwriters of Dolomite Is My Name, the story of how Rudy Ray Moore came to make the film Dolomite, starring Eddie Murphy. For our listeners, could you just identify yourselves so maybe they can try and tell you
about it? Sure. This is Larry Karaszewski.
And this is Scott Alexander.
Or this is Scott.
Considering how long the two of you have worked together as a writing team, do you ever come to feel like one person, as if like one could answer all the questions or things for the other one?
That's the absolute truth. When we are being interviewed, a lot of times it's really just a tag team. And
if I drop dead, it won't matter.
Yeah.
You can still do the podcast without me.
With Dolomite Is My Name, as I understand it, the two of you get a call. Eddie Murphy wants to meet with you to talk about Rudy Ray Moore. Mm-hmm. That just sounds like almost like a Mad Lib of like things you would like.
It was very magical and special. And it was a very long time ago. This was 2002, 2003. And our agent said, Eddie Murphy wants to meet you guys. We're like, really? Why? He says, I have no idea, but it's Eddie Murphy. We go, yeah, it's Eddie Murphy. So we go and we meet with Eddie, and he just launches into performing scenes from Ed Wood, which we wrote back in 1994. And he's doing Tor Johnson, and he's doing Bela Lugosi. And we're like, oh my God, this is crazy. He's a real fan. And then he says, do you guys know who Rudy Ray Moore is? And we just crack up because we were total fans of Rudy Ray. We're like, okay, he likes Ed Wood. He likes Rudy. We see where this is going.
Yeah. Scott and I were roommates in the 80s, and a fellow screenwriter named Daniel Waters, who wrote the movie Heathers, was actually a manager at a video store.
Video House.
Video House in Silver Lake. And Dan brought home a tape one day, a VHS, that was called The Best of Sex and Violence. And it was a collection of exploitation trailers.
Hosted by John Carradine.
Yes, but it was all mostly like Roger Corman stuff or Filipino women in prison kind of movies. But in the center, there was three trailers back to back to back. And they were three Rudy Ray Moore trailers. It was Dolomite, Human Tornado, and Disco Godfather. And it just blew our minds. We became completely obsessed. Anyone who came over our house, we'd show them these trailers. We'd sit them down. We just became obsessed with Rudy Ray Moore. And since Dan ran the video store, we didn't have to give the tape back.
For you young people, if you wanted to buy a movie, it cost about $100 back then. And so it was discouraged. And I decided I wanted to buy Larry Human Tornado for his birthday. So I actually had to look up this video company, Xenon Video, in the phone book and then drive out to their warehouse. And I showed up with cash. And they didn't have a cash register or a cashier, so they were a little puzzled.
Did you get the tape?
Yeah, I got the tape. And that's when it all began.
So it was funny. In that initial meeting, we could do Rudy Ray Moore lines back to Eddie. And so it was great is that about 2 days later, Eddie got us in a room with the real Rudy Ray Moore.
To kind of back up, what did the two of you like about Rudy's movies in the first place, like even before the project came up, when you were just fans of Rudy?
Simply the one-of-a-kindness. There's literally no other personality out there like Rudy Ray Moore. His movies kind of came at the tail end of the blaxploitation craze, so they're actually kind of parodies of the blaxploitation movies. They're more outrageous than the blaxploitation movies are. I mean, they're pretty much insane. You can look at them as action movies. You can look at them as, you know, as comedies. I think we give Rudy a line in the movie, it's a total entertainment experience, and it is. But the one of a kindness is actually, I think, why he's survived so long, because there certainly were much bigger blaxploitation movies back in the 70s. Rudy's movies simply are just different than everything else. So right now, when people talk about blaxploitation, they talk about Shaft, Superfly, Dolomite. But in 1975, that was not the case.
Did you find that what you liked about Rudy's movies was lined up with what Eddie liked about Rudy's movies? Were your visions of Rudy sort of all in sync?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, like Larry's used the word singular, and that just Rudy just had a complete bananas committed screen presence. It wasn't so much the, they're making low budget movies and they don't know how to make a film. That wasn't really what was interesting to us. This was a man with a vision.
Yeah, the force of personality. I mean, even in those trailers, each one of those trailers gets to a point where the credits come on and Rudy says, "Starring me, Rudy Ray Moore." And the idea, the audaciousness of starring me, you know.
He's just always bragging.
Another thing that we sunk up with Eddie on was that the do-it-yourself quality of these movies. Not much was known about many of these people who helped Rudy make his movies. And so I remember the first couple of meetings with Eddie where we'd sit there and say, is that a real person? Like, point to a director's name. Is that a real person? Because we don't know if that's like a pseudonym for, like, you know, for Rudy. Because Rudy has so many different credits on the movie. And sometimes he's R.R. Moore. And sometimes he's, you know. And so we were, you know, very curious about all these other characters. And as, you know, we got to know them. But the quality that Rudy was making these movies out on the street without a permit. We always would bring up the idea that there's a fight scene outside of a Ralph's grocery store. It didn't end up being in our film. But it just looks like they pulled up at a Ralph's and noticed there was a place where no cars were parked and let's have a kung fu fight here. And Scott and I also, we when we were growing up, we did Super 8 movies. So we were very much those kind of kids who had little Super 8 cameras making little movies on our block and getting our friends to be in them.
So we really admired that about Rudy and the fact that, you know, his pals show up in different degrees, sometimes on camera, sometimes in the credits, on the crew, you know, throughout his run of pictures. So he had loyalty.
And then what was it like the day that you got to meet Rudy Ray Moore?
It was fantastic because, first of all, we came in sort of as Dolomite. I mean, he came in fully dressed.
He showed up in the outfit.
Yeah, he was, you know, and so it was like, holy shit, you're meeting Dolomite. But I think that our big takeaway from that day was that after a little while of just talking to him, that sort of faded away.
Initially, he's doing the bragging and he's doing the, well, who's going to star in this movie? We go, well, you know, Eddie wants to play. He says, don't you think I should? You know. Well, Rudy, you're in your 70s and
starring me. That's you're older the one and, starring me.
You know, so he's sort of putting on those airs, which is, you know, that showboat thing he would do. But, you know, after a certain point, then he's just talking about what he's been up to and what his life was like then. And, you know, he was an old comic on the road. And that's a rough life.
I mean, I'd seen him at the Club Lingerie in like the 90s, and you know, he'd do his set, then he'd put that merch table, which I think we were maybe the first movie ever to have a merch table in the film, but that was definitely how Rudy made a living.
Yeah, and it's not an easy life.
We did some Q&A somewhere, and they said, what do you think Rudy would be doing now if he saw your film? We said, he'd be setting out the merch table in the lobby and selling you a t-shirt on the way out.
We saw that there was the character of Dolman, and then there was the man. And they were very different people. And this really stayed with us. And this ended up being what the movie was about.
Because I think that's something that is very surprising, even for people that know the movies, is in Dolman Is My Name, to learn this sort of entrepreneurial aspect of what he did and how hard Rudy worked to get even, you know, what little success he had.
Yeah, that bluster was a character.
Right.
But the real guy was very soft-spoken.
Because his success was so hit and miss and so minimal at times, he had to do everything himself. No one ever helped him. You know, he had to make his own records. He had to make his own movie. He was always sort of left alone to his own devices in order to create this kind of mini industry of Rudy Ray Moore.
And, you know, and even though he was, you know, the producer, financier, star, I mean, there was a story that we weren't able to fit into the movie where they just ran out of bread for sandwiches to feed the crew lunch. And so he was just like, well, screw it. Someone has to do this. And he just jumped in his car, drove to that Ralph's and ran down the bread aisle in his Dolomite suit. You know, and there's not a lot of stars who will do that.
Do you get a lot of calls like this of people, you know, they have like a person that they think would be a good fit for you? Like, do you hear from a lot of people about a lot of other people?
Yes, we do. It's an easy pitch for them.
They're misled because they think they could just say a name to us.
Right. That's what happens. As opposed to like if, you know, we were writing whatever, family comedy or something, they'd have to actually come to us with an idea for a family comedy. Us, it can be just someone picking up the phone and saying, Roger Stone, or, you know, or Benjamin Harrison. And they're like, what about Benjamin Harrison? I don't know. You guys do something about Benjamin Harrison, you know. They're able to say one word and then think that they're telling us, they're giving us an idea, but it's not really the case. We say no. We almost never do it.
If you look at our body of work, we kind of like telling the same story over and over. We like telling stories of completely passionate people with what's kind of a bad idea, but they really believe in their idea and it's important to them and they want to express themselves. And so they're pushing a very big rock up a very steep hill and everyone in society is saying, just stop it. Just give up. Just turn around and go the direction the rest of us are going. But our person says, no, no, no. This is just something that's important to me. And I'm going to keep pushing this rock. And we like telling that story.
How did you sort of come to have this be the business you're in? I mean, this sort of oddball Americana, making these movies about people like Ed Wood, Larry Flint, Andy Kaufman, Margaret Keane. When did you realize there was this kind of through line to all these characters?
I mean, we stumbled into it. After the Problem Child movies, we were typecast as the guys who write family junk.
Right.
And we were trying to set up smarter projects and we couldn't.
Right. We were actually pitching things and people would say, oh, that's a really good idea, but you guys are the Problem Child guys. And so we were being told that we weren't good enough to write our own ideas. And we realized that wasn't a place we wanted to be.
It was very disheartening.
Yeah.
And we started talking about Ed Wood. And Ed Wood at the time was famous as the guy that people laughed at. And
right.
He was in
the worst filmmaker of all time.
The Golden Turkey Awards, right. Worst film ever made. And there were film festivals and then people would just come out and make fun of him. And we started sympathizing with Ed because we didn't set out for Problem Child to be a terrible film. It was a very popular film and it's very beloved. And people sometimes call it a classic for some reason, but it's not a classic. Citizen Kane is a classic. But we started looking at Ed going, well, he came to Hollywood and he had big dreams and he wanted to be a director and he directed six features. Instead of making fun of that, what if we celebrated that? And this idea of telling a two-hour story about someone who really wasn't famous was novel and weird. Back then, you know, this was early 90s when we did this, and, you know, a biopic meant, meant Gandhi. It meant Chaplin.
Patton.
It was
there were
like,
three-hour movies that are about great men or great, great, great accomplishments.
You know, yeah, people of note, people of achievement.
Right.
What if you just tell a story about Ed, a guy who no one's ever heard of, but he had an interesting life. And then, you know, and then he had sort of had his run with Lugosi, and then things puttered out in the 60s, and by the 70s, he was an alcoholic and making porn, and it got really grim. We said, well, forget all that. Well, let's just like, what if we just focus on sort of those five magical years when he was working with his hero, Bela Lugosi? we could sort of shape the story to be inspiring. Back in 92, when we started to write this movie, we weren't saying, oh, this is going to be our life's calling. We were sort of feeling beat down by Hollywood, right. And we were identifying with Ed, and we were saying, let's just be cheerleaders for Ed Wood for 2 hours.
And what's interesting is when we initially came up with the idea, we thought it was going to be more of a low-budget Sundance kind of thing, and it ended up on Tim Burton's desk, and it became this movie that sort of, you know, won Academy Awards, and it made the whole town pay attention to us. And because we had been sort of typecast as the problem child guys, we knew how quickly they pigeonhole you. And so I think we knew this was kind of an opportunity, perhaps, to get another one of these made. I didn't think we were, at the time, thinking we were going to do, you know, 10 of them. But we thought, like, when we were in college, Larry Flint had sort of hijacked the Metro section of the LA Times. And when it was all that period where he was, like, throwing oranges at judges and things like that. And
he was in court in a diaper.
Yeah. So we'd read these stories when we were roommates in college, and we were laughing our heads off. And we always thought that would make a really interesting movie. But, of course, nobody would want to make a movie about the guy who invented Hustler magazine. But we had this really, you know, short window where we could go into an office and kind of present it, and it wound up selling. So once the two of them happened, we realized that this is sort of almost a genre that we could revel in.
I mean, and nobody else was writing these kind of movies. Nobody else was writing movies about oddballs in the margins.
Right.
And there wasn't, you know, there wasn't a book about Larry Flint, because people were repelled by Larry Flint. We were the guys saying, okay, well, the magazine is gross and Larry's obnoxious, but isn't it a great story? I mean, he was so poor that he was born in a home with a dirt floor. He made $100 million. He ran for president. He got shot going to a courthouse fighting for free speech. I mean, this is a hell of a story. Despite the fact that you may find the magazine gross, it's a good story. We weren't trying to put Larry on a pedestal, but we were trying to say, you should take a look at this. This is a great piece of Americana.
The key things about all of our characters are they're sincere. They are making their art, if you want to call it art, for themselves. Ed Wood wants to make those monster movies.
And then and Rudy wants to see Dolomite.
Yeah.
And Margaret Keane wants to see those paintings of the kids with the big eyes.
Right.
They all love their work. Larry Flint loves Hustler magazine. So they're all sincere.
Larry Flint is not talking down to his audience. He is his audience. It's the same thing with Rudy Ray Moore. Rudy Ray Moore wants funny titties and action. A friend of ours said to us, coming out of the screen, when he's like the worst studio executive of all time. He just wants more explosions. He just doesn't want to get bored in a movie. But it's coming from a sincere place.
Yeah, and it's so much so that all of Rudy's movies, because Rudy's life was, as we say, it was all about nightclubs. And
it's what he knows. He writes what
he knows, and he spent his whole life playing clubs. And all of his movies just shut down at some point for a 10 or 15 variety show. Here comes the tap dancer. Here comes the R&B group. Here comes the lady singing a ballad. Here comes the shake dancer. And it's just sort of, I think he was just trying to entertain himself.
And also bring his friends in the movie. Oh, you've got that great song, come sing it. Sometimes reminds me of like an old Warner Brothers movies where like a Bogart gangster movie will just shut, they'll be chased into a nightclub and they'll sit down at a table and all of a sudden a woman come out and sing for 10 minutes. It's like, this has absolutely nothing to do with the movie. But
specialty
just,
number.
They just want to entertain.
You mentioned how the Dolomite Project, it sort of first came up and then, you know, it was a number of years before you actually got the movie.
Right.
It was too obscure. It was too R-rated. It was sort of like, what's the point?
Right.
Eddie at the time was firmly entrenched in family films, and this was hard R rating.
Yeah. I mean, I always assumed that a studio executive would go, after we leave the room, like, go watch that Human Tornado trailer and say, no, come on. I'm being punked here. They're not really proposing this.
So, the project just went away, and a few years later, Rudy passed away, and we felt bad. Probably a 15-year gap. And then after O.J., Peele versus O.J., you know, we had a little bit of heat again. We always like to use our chits when we have them, because the chits come and go.
Right.
And you can
use them for good.
Yeah. We can have, you know, years where we're on a roll and then years where we can't get anything made. And when stuff is going well, we try to piggyback on that.
Well, tell me about that. Like, how do you sort of recognize your moment when it comes? Like, after the People versus O.J. Simpson, did you know that, like, you had kind of a window?
The listeners of your podcast know the mid-budget dramas have sort of stopped being made by the major studios. And the mid-budget comedy dramas were our bread and butter. And we, you know, look back at, you know, Ed Wood and, you know, man, I mean, these were major studio pictures. They weren't run through the art division. They were just mainstream. But things were changing and studios were making fewer and fewer films. So then we dipped our toe into TV with OJ, and OJ was his big hit and won awards, and people really liked it. And so we sort of thought, well, maybe we can put the band back together with Rudy. And maybe this is a moment where we can strike and sell it.
Right. But, you know, we didn't know if Eddie was still interested.
We hadn't talked to him in 15
years. Yeah, we
didn't
talk to him. And also, he basically kind of retired. And on top of that, it had now been 20 years since he said the F word in a movie. So we didn't even know if he would like remotely want to go back to that. And so through the producers, John Davis and John Fox, we got word back to Eddie sort of saying, hey, we want to do this. Are you interested? And it was almost like a flip of the meeting 15 years ago where like, he was running. Yes, I still want to do it.
So now we were pitching to Eddie.
Yeah. And you know, next week or so, we were in the office of Netflix. And I think they really wanted to be in the Eddie Murphy business and sold. I mean, what's funny is because we'd been rejected years earlier because we think studio executives really didn't understand who Rudy Ray Moore was.
Or why he mattered.
We actually came into this pitch meeting like really prepared to tell the executives like, you know, how important Rudy is and how he invented rap and all this kind of things. And we walk in and it's Ted Sarandos actually came to the meeting and we start doing it. And he's like, oh, no, I ran video stores in the 80s. I know Rudy Ray Moore. He kept us in business. People would rent those tapes over and over and over again. And so it was like almost half of our pitch was like thrown out the window. So we barely even had the pitch anymore. Eddie got up and started doing Signifying Monkey, and the project was sold.
And now tell me what it was like working with Eddie, not just to see him as a performer, but as a producer and a collaborator. What was sort of his input to the story? How involved was he? Like, what was it like working with him kind of behind the scenes?
During the writing of the first draft, we weren't working with Eddie. We were trying
to please Eddie.
We were trying to please Eddie, and we were trying to write the best part possible for Eddie because we're giant fans, and we sort of felt like Eddie had fallen off the grid. We hadn't seen him in years, and this movie could let him be funny. It could let him be touching. It could let him be musical. It could let him do stand-up. It was a whole Eddie package. We wanted to show off everything that's great about Eddie and great about Rudy.
We were writing a tribute to Rudy Ray Moore, but we were also writing a tribute to Eddie Murphy.
Larry and I love doing our research, and we love lots of obscure trivia and weird little facts, and we considered lots of little Easter eggs we put in the script just for Eddie. Because whatever, Eddie's been doing this since he was a teenager, so he goes way back, and we knew he would get all our references to like just obscure 70s stuff. And we wanted to please Eddie, because we figured if Eddie loves the script, Netflix is going to say yes. And if Eddie doesn't like the script, then why would Netflix even follow up on the project? The whole point of the movie is the excitement is to see Eddie in this part. And so we were just trying to make Eddie happy. I mean, you know, once the movie, you know, geared up, we saw a lot more of Eddie.
Yeah, and definitely Eddie was instrumental in getting Craig Brewer. He loved Hustle and Flow, instrumental in a lot of the cast.
Yeah, I mean, once word got out that the movie's going and it's Eddie playing Rudy.
Right.
I mean, Rudy means so much to a generation of comics, especially black comics. Mm. And then the return of Eddie full force in an R-rated movie was so exciting.
And now, what was it like when, I mean, as you mentioned, Eddie had not been in an R-rated movie for some 20 years. Right. So the first time he's cussing up a storm as Rudy on set.
It was amazing.
So cool.
Yeah, it was. I mean, literally almost chills went up our back. And I remember we leaned over to each other and said, I feel like we just wrote a movie for Clark Gable or somebody. It was like a hologram in front of us of a great old star that you hadn't seen in a movie in forever.
It's Eddie full force.
It's Eddie full force. And I can't think of anyone who's ever been gone that long who came back full force. Or maybe even more powerful. This was Eddie firing on all cylinders. And so it wasn't like, oh, this is his best movie in 5 years. It's his best movie in 20 years, or maybe his best movie ever.
To have Eddie come back with that primal energy we remember from 48 Hours is just so incredible.
The two of you mentioned changes in the industry and the fact that this movie was made by Netflix. Right. Knowing that the two of you are such big film fans, do you have any conflicted feelings about that? I mean, is there any sense of the fact that the movie will get a limited theatrical release, but it will be available to so many millions of people? How do you feel about that?
I feel fantastic that they're making these movies. I mean, you look at the movies Netflix is making this season, and it's like they're making, you know,
making all the best movies.
They're making the best movies. We grew up in the 70s. They're making, you know, they're making the Irishman. They're making our movie. They're making Marriage Story. They're making Two Popes. I mean, these are really, really good films. And they're making them with budgets. And people are getting paid. And it's actually like you can feel it on the screen.
I have grown to feel so much affection towards the two of you as kind of like movie nerds made good. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, I feel like the story of Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski would make a really great Scott Alexander and Larry Kierzewski movie.
Well, yeah, we're not that interesting.
Yes, yes.
I don't know if we're quirky enough.
I don't know if we're Charlie Kaufman-esque enough to do it. I fully expect someday I'll open that, you know, when they announce
the blacklist
and some clever little bastard will have done, you know, number three on the blacklist will be Scott and Larry.
Now we used to joke about our own biopic years ago because you have to combine stuff because you've only got 2 hours to tell the story. And so you got to put people in the room together who maybe weren't in the room together just so you can fit everyone into the story. And we've always joked that there would be a scene with us driving around in my convertible with me, Larry, Tim Burton, and John Ritter.
We're wrapping up Problem Child, but we got to talk to Tim Burton.
Which never happened.
Right.
But somehow John and Tim would know each other in our biopic.
Well, the movie is Dolomite Is My Name. Scott, Larry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, all great. Right. Thank you.
Mark.
That's it for this week's show. Thanks to our producer, Paige Heimsen, and our audio engineer, Mike Heflin. Subscribe to The Real on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star review. You can also visit us at latimes.com/The Real.